You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the lives of artists looking for balance in a business that doesn't give them much control. What do they do to keep themselves from going to the dark side? How do they find balance in their lives when they're making work but not necessarily making their entire living from it? This is a space for these conversations with my peers. I need to hear their perspectives because I'm struggling through the same challenges. I'm Leah Walsh, and this is the first episode of the Compass podcast. I'm so happy today to be talking with Alejandro Rodriguez, who was a classmate of mine at Juilliard. He's an actor, a teacher, a writer, and an all-around wonderful guy and thinker. I always feel renewed after having a conversation with him, so I'm happy to share that with all of you. Welcome to The Compass, Episode 1.
You said it right. I don't make a living exclusively performing. And that has come about, as many of us, partly because certain doors that I knocked on were closed. Because I think the blunt truth is, if one of the big like pilot auditions I'd gone on when I got out of school would have, you know, booked for three seasons or whatever, or like I got a feature film that made me, I don't know where I'd be. I doubt I would be exactly where I'm at, and so I think it's naive for me to say, like, I have selected at every moment, I have chosen this path. I think it's a little bit of coincidence and accidents in which doors did swing open and which people were like, come and work for me. Some of them, writers, directors, actors, others, administrators, educators, activists, you know. But I can say that now in a different way with a different quality because so much of me arriving at this point has been deliberate and the process of conversations like this, of writing in my journal, of talking to my mom, you know, like, and having gotten through that and now actually standing and proudly to say like, oh no, I do a mix of things. Not only do I do a mix of things because I'm artistically interested in a mix of things, but I do a mix of things to live in New York City and stay afloat. I do a mix of things to eat out every now and then. There's a number of reasons that I can say I've thought through that my like time in the city has been diversified outside of just commercial acting, rehearsing, performing. I mean, auditioning, rehearsing, performing. So partly by accident, and partly my being really conscious of like, oh wait, that I'm not entirely quenched by this, or I am really restless when other people have the keys to my schedule. Like, I don't deal well with
into
that.
Into your future.
And my future and my travel plans and the amount of time I see my family, which you know, actually probably that's the first battlefront for me with the commercial acting industry. The first trench, you know, was my ability or not disability, my lack of ability to go see my grandparents and my nephews. There, I can remember instances, Leah, where like I'd be getting ready to book the flight, or actually had booked the flight, and I'd be in on a subway, seeing if I could like get away for a long weekend. And here come with the appointment. You know, Beth Bowling wants to see you at.
And it's that mixed blessing of like, yay, they want to see me. Oh, I'm trying to live my life. Exactly. I really want to live my life
really
this weekend.
I live my life, and my family is hugely important. And so is an opportunity to do what I love, right? And to make some money doing what I love. Mm-hmm. Let me be even more specific. But that dilemma happening to me two or three times forced me to like wrestle a little bit more decision-making capacity, so that I actually, even more specifically, got an appointment while I was down. I forget what it was. Oh, I think it was because a casting director had given me my first TV job and was calling me back in for another TV show. So, but I'm like there in Miami where I grew up, about to celebrate like, I don't know, my dad and mom's anniversary, something. And I have this like paralyzing moment of, do I get on a plane and go try to chase this audition down, and this opportunity down, knowing that there's a chance that it might work out for me? Or do I say like, no, so-and-so, I'm actually away right now and you can't have my time. And that being in Miami, having to make that particular decision, was somehow like a microcosm of like winning a larger war to say like, I will go in when certain factors work out, and otherwise, mm-hmm. I can have a little bit of say too about.
Well, making that decision from Miami as opposed to before you went to Miami,
totally,
is a huge thing too, totally. As far as the guilt factor.
Oh yeah, and because you know, here we're surrounded by people who are making. Some of who are making similar decisions with their time, but other people that we care about and we spend time with who are looking at those same decisions and making them differently, mm-hmm. because they relate to their free time or their family or travel differently than you. And so I find this city particularly challenging because I spend my time with people who I love and who I think there should be some synchronicity. I like, right? Our minds work similarly.
Yeah, this is the same situation.
Same situation. But that's dangerous because they, I don't know, they may have, like, they may Skype often with their family and that satisfies them well. But my family doesn't get on Skype. And so I wait to see them, you know, or I don't know, maybe they get more, they've found a way of like flowing with their day, with their jobby job and taking whatever comes. And I actually really admire people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about how like piss poor the script that they're working on is. Like they just immediately do the best job that they can with it. And I never had that, or not, I want to say never had, but that's not, doesn't come easy to me. Like I'm constantly reflecting like, this is what I'm spending my time on. This is what I'm doing. Right.
Like, is this the best use of my time?
That plagues me. That is both a question that has led me here in positive ways, and it's also a question that, like, I a friend of mine who I was in Johannesburg recently, who's doing great things, and now I got, like, a burgeoning TV thing going on, but he's also does work as a facilitator, as an improv performer and teacher. And he was saying that he empathized with me because he analyzes actions and events in his life very diligently, but for some reason has never allowed himself to consider like an eject button as an actor, because he says it's a deliberate blind spot that he's created for like commercial acting auditions, where in so many other aspects of his life, he says, I'm with you. I think, like, is this valuable? Is this worthwhile? But he said, I had to create this sort of neurosis of, like, not looking at that, not thinking about how I spent 3 hours putting this self-tape together. And it made me wonder, like, about that sort of willed, like, I won't go there. I won't question it. Because if I do, then the demons are there. You know what
right.
I mean? Like,
if even if the material isn't something that I necessarily believe in, but I know it would pay me a paycheck.
Da, 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 and they're going marching, and they're going in the direction. Yeah. And I sort of saw that, and I said, "Oh, I could see how that might have kept me tunnel visioned for longer had I refused to like question it at all." And he said it came from a place of like a young juvenile place of like not wanting to lose at anything. Yeah. And he said, I had told my people back home that I was going to go do this as an actor, and I just was not willing to return a loss. And I said, I hear that. I'm glad to say that it's not exactly, I don't feel exactly the same, but I really recognize that as one of the reasons why you're like, not thinking about it. Doesn't matter. Not thinking about it. It's an audition. I'm saying yes.
But you feel you've come to a point where you are discerning about the material, or like?
I think I have. I think I've gotten to a place now where I look at an appointment and I say, how many months of my life is this? Who will be in the room? What is the quality of the time that I can imagine spending on this project? And then I put myself out there. I put myself into the interview, the appointment. And I say interview because I think I go through the same process with any project that gets offered me. Teaching, you know, sometimes people, ASAP will have like, oh, go to volunteer on this site or lead this program. And it satisfies a couple of criteria, but then I think I'm away from my girlfriend, I'm away from my community. It's not worth it. Maybe the money makes it. And I think money is a major factor in that regard. And which is another reason why sometimes it makes economic sense to keep a fish, a rod in the pool of like the commercial acting thing. And I've never envisioned it as a binary where I'd have to leave it entirely ever, because if an audition comes and it works out, like you love acting, like that it's
right. If they pay you to do what you love, then great.
Then great. And I think that's another sort of thought disease that we have, is thinking about like, did you leave it or are you in it? Like, so black and white, like, oh, you're not doing that anymore, you changed that. Well, no, maybe I'm being more discerning about, like, you may be in a season of your life where you don't want to leave the city, so you're not taking regional auditions, right? You might be in a period of your life where you actually are only wanting to go on like only commercial. Like I can see a lot of the actors who I meet in commercial auditions who I don't see in legit auditions having lifestyles that allow them to do a bunch of cast a wide net of commercials and have other jobs that they do to earn income. The way that you put the Jenga together, to use a favorite metaphor of mine, is I think can be healthy a lot of different ways. And we get really dramatic about it. Mm-hmm. You're not doing that anymore? Oh, sorry. Sorry. So what are you sorry? Think of it as career evolution.
We kind of surpassed the initial question.
Sorry.
But in a good way. In a good way.
That will be a problem of mine.
I knew that would be you.
Yeah.
But the initial question is, what do you do when you feel yourself going to that dark side?
Yeah.
About being an artist.
I do a handful of different things, all of with the goal, I think, of zooming out. Because I find... fortunately, I have an appetite for like nonfiction, for history, for politics. The moment I get onto anything that zooms me out of my present,
like just you
conundrum, exactly,
as an individual,
because suddenly, instantaneously, you realize like, oh, I'm doing a super rarefied job, or trying to do a super rarefied job, which. Yeah. Is for an incredibly limited demographic of people who do it, right? I've been, you know, just the fact that I'm going on auditions in this city means that I've already surpassed a huge percentile of the people trying to do this really strange and weird job in this very strange, for a limited number of people. And you see how this is starting to happen, like as you go more macro, a lot of the very peculiar anxieties of like, I'm a failure. I'm not sizing up. It's like, no, you're talking about play acting, and it's something that is structured because of the economics and the way the industry is built. It's not looking exclusively for your talent or your spirit or your artistic. It's looking for a cog in a production that they're trying to make, and how many people are ultimately gonna see it. Like, I don't know, I find that for me the best thing to do is listen to some music, read a book, go to the park, anything that allows me to remember that I am a speck of dust and that my contribution is valid, but it's also like small, and in particular as an actor, like, what was I trying to get? What was I trying to do that I failed at that sent me into this dark place? Chances are it's not the thing that is going to ultimately like define me or go down as a testament of who I am. It's probably just like a play that would have been nice to do, or four or five lines on a television show that some people will see, you know?
Right.
It isn't like... the thing that I think about, people will be talking around my like casket, you know, which is a pretty moribund thing to say, but that's another way of drawing the lens wide, is thinking about mortality. Like, we lost a friend of ours, a very dear friend of mine at school, you know, and I've lost another friend since very young, in their early 20s. And those were incredibly sad experiences, but incredibly liberating and with relationship to this stuff, because I go back to those people and it's an immediate zoom out, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, oh yeah. What am I dark about? Like,
right.
I'm in my 20s. I can actually make a radical pivot if I wanted to. Yeah.
And go. And I can try harder
And I can try harder in this moment and let go of whatever small things I could let go of. And I'm not saying it's easy. Sometimes they linger, like a bad audition or not being treated fairly, like feeling mm-hmm. the injustices of the industry, which are many. I don't want to posit that as like, oh, just think about your friend who died and like, and you'll immediately Ooh. Forget about it. No, it's not like that. Sometimes that you're like, fuck it, I'm still pissed, you know?
No, but that's part of your experience and it's a thing you can draw on.
Yeah, but I do think it's let go-able. You're choosing to keep chewing on it and to keep it in your mandible, like as a thing you're turning over, like, fuck this casting thing, or fuck this way that they ran the audition, or fuck the way they treat like minorities and women, like, you know, and I think that as long as you recognize that there's value and usefulness in sitting and tearing on it, you also can come home, get a bath, pour a glass of wine, you can put it aside, it's going to be there in the morning, you know what mm-hmm. I mean, like, and so you don't always have to be embattled. You find little tricks to relieve yourself for a second, for a night's rest.
And I know for you, like, a huge part of your life now is teaching.
Yeah.
Is that something that you always thought would be there, or like, when was the moment when that happened, or it snuck up on you, or...
Yeah, snuck up on me, and I don't even like...
I mean, I've watched it happen, but...
Yeah, because
for you.
What's weird is I still... the first line of my bio, whenever someone asks me for my bio, is always like this metaphysical... I think maybe we've spoken about this metaphysical dilemma every time, because I write like, Alejandro Rodriguez is an actor, educator... Backspace. Is an actor, teacher... Backspace. Is a, you know... Because I'm watching myself struggle with these labels, with identities, you know? And teacher's still one... It's probably the thing, Leah, that I can tell you comes most naturally to me. And still, I can say that and am finding my comfort inside of this, like, label and this, because I just never mm-hmm. thought of it as my lifestyle. I thought of myself as, like, I don't know, like an abstract expressionist painter in the village with paint on my pants and like a journal everywhere I go. And some of that, I still have paint on my pants and I do carry a journal, but I feel useful when I'm teaching, and that was a surprise. And I don't know, other than that I had to at some point admit to myself that I was good at it, as good or better than I was naturally as an actor. And I that is not to put myself down as an actor. I think that I bring a lot to text, you know. I certainly try my darnest, and I've worked really hard, but I didn't ever take any pedagogy classes, and I just understood something about connecting with young people. And I think it's partly because I affirm from my own place of like messiness and insecurity and wandering, I affirm that in them, you know? And I also affirm the fact that they can be lifelong artists, whether or not they decide to monetize the art, right? Like, I think a banner that I wave high in everything, every educational place I go to, is like, you can do this. This can feed you for the rest of your life. And that is a separate decision than like whether you want to get legit representation or live in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. Like, art is our inheritance. You remember that thing that Richard shared with us about the theater is a calling. a passion, a craft. Mm-hmm. It's now on the Juilliard website. I wanted to learn it because he listed a lot of things that the theater can be. And what has dawned on me in my time out of school is that it isn't always all of those things at the same time. Because one of them is like, it's an industry, it's a profession, it's a calling, it's a political act. And I guess the idea that a young person finding the theater or music or dance can find a way to keep it in their life without having to have that be a narrow, like...
I feel like that's such a pressure in our society for some reason, is to monetize everything. Anything you do should be the way you support yourself, the way you make money.
Yeah.
And I know it's frustrating as a artist to put that pressure on yourself, but also as a teacher to like teach young people, like there's so many benefits of arts education and learning those skills and interpersonal relationships and all of those things. But keeping out of it the fact that now it's this social media world where it's like everyone wants to be a star and like the performing arts has been taken over in some ways by that world.
Yeah. I don't...
It's strange.
In a weird way, like, I think... that they share like genetic material with the performing arts, like the viral videos and the movement and the activity that there is on there. And I have certainly seen webisodes and stuff made for the digital world that is as impactful and as artful as other stuff. But I also see a lot of the effort as motivated from a different place, I think, than what brought us, for example, to conservatory. Like, as I investigate what my motivations were, like, they're really old and self-serious as so, like, like to tell great story to, I can, yeah. You can look at my live journal from high school. I wonder if I'd find similar things in diaries of yours.
I would love that.
That say things like, I want to help tell my generation story, right, to my generation. I want to help document,
communicate Shakespeare to young people.
To young people, yeah. Like these big, and I think that the idea of it being viral or visible, if it entered into my like mathematics, it did much, much later and came and went. You know, I see the people who have like hits in their mind and getting likes, and they are amazing at those things. I have no idea how to go about that. I mean, in some instances I've had to learn just to produce, like help a play get, you know, people in the seats. Produced, or like, yeah, exactly. And you pick up a skill or two because increasingly that's has to be part of your toolkit too. But the basic motivation of what draws somebody to like update weekly with 2-minute videos to keep their following like active and is not familiar to me. I'm motivated to have like deep conversations around tables with like pages in front of us about words and characters and that's okay. I think all of those people can find a place. I hope we still have a place. People like us in New York, we kind of do, but I. It scares me. It scares me that the two things are melding into one, and that increasingly, I don't know if you've heard this, but like people telling like reps telling their actors that, oh, the day will come when you'll be cast based on like your likes or how many retweets.
That terrifies me.
Yeah, right. It's kind of
terrifies scary. Me. Like how many Instagram followers you have or whatever. Right.
You've heard that too.
Yeah.
So I'm not making that up. Yeah, I don't. That'll be the time that I don't work in that particular the industry that's fueled by that. I don't know if it's mine,
we both know people who defy that, who don't participate in any of those social media things and succeed beyond belief. But it's scary to think that those decisions are being made based on that.
Yeah, and I wonder if our realm is like an offline one, like it's based on the quality of like the live exchange. Mm-hmm. Maybe maybe it's naive to think that we'll be like ushered out entirely. Maybe we'll just need to partner with people who have a fluency in the digital sphere, but maybe our skills or our interests will remain part of the conversation, because, you know, you can be as good as you want about getting people into a room, but what you do with them in the room, who you put on stage in front of them, is still going to matter, you know?
Yeah.
It's still going to matter. And so, I don't know, a really well-trained actor is a valuable thing, and I want to think that's going to be true.
Can I ask, because it's something that I struggle with,
yeah,
how you commit yourself as a teacher while still keeping yourself open to possible opportunities as an actor?
Yeah.
Without feeling like, oh my God, I can't commit to this, because what if an audition comes up? What if such and such comes up?
No, that's a very good question. And it's a good question because I can't answer it other than to say, like, I have literally stolen lines from emails or phrases that I've heard someone say that I think, oh, that didn't sound dickish, and that was super clear and transparent and wasn't noncommittal. Like, for example, when getting an offer, first of all, one thing that I've started to do is just always say, can I have some time to think about it? Whether you have a yes on your mouth or a no on your lips, like, always just saying, can I get 24 hours? I'll get right. Thank you for the offer. Can I get 24 hours? And then crafting a response that is clear in the forefront as possible, which is like, hey, just to be clear, if a performance opportunity comes up, if it's like before this date, if you're willing to commit yourself fully after a certain date, you may have to say, if a performance opportunity comes up, period, I might have to leave. At that point, your employer gets to decide whether that's a risk they want to take, you know? But
as a teacher.
Yeah. And mind you, for a while as a teaching artist in the city, most of my engagements were an afternoon, two or three days, which I could either book myself out, or like if I had to leave for a quick audition. I'm answering your question from the lens of being offered like a semester.
Right, which I know you do.
Which for me is a different, more difficult thing in terms of responding, because that's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. But let's go back. Even the afternoon thing, if Mechie, for example, our classmate Mechie, who does a lot of work with the Classical Theater of Harlem and has her fingers in so many cool cookie jars in terms of theater and education, she will ask me, hey, can you come up to Project Classics and do an afternoon on August, I don't know, 18th, right? Asking her, you know, as many questions as I need to give her an answer, you know, compensation, preparation, am I teaching with a co-teacher, like how long is it? And then if I know there is a chance that something might take me away that time, being clear with her that hey, just so you know that I'm continuing to audition through that time. Though the realistic truth is, I think a lot of time the fear that we can't sign up for things, especially that are still in the city, because something might take us away, is something that we amplify in our own minds. Because mm-hmm. most of the time I realize, like, if I've agreed to do something from 2 to 4 with Mechie and I get an appointment, like, I could ask. I've gotten a lot better at just asking, like, hey, are there other times in the day that mm-hmm. they can do that? Or do they have a session the day before? Do they have a session the day afterwards? And, you know, sometimes you get a no and you have to make a hard decision. But just, you know, your Google Calendar is your friend, and transparency in terms of telling people,
just
like...
Just talking about it.
Because I think it's on them. And as somebody who hires freelancers too now, or engages them, I've had to learn, like, all right, if I actually am going to lose money... Or something more valuable, but let's say money, for example, because you back out on me, mm-hmm. right? Let's say the week of. Then I have a couple of things. As somebody who's engaging you as a teaching artist, Leah, I can say, hey, if you agree to this by August 13th, you know, it's going to be firm, or you have to give us the stipend that we had set aside for you, you know?
Right.
With A-Step, for example, sometimes we engage people to take like a train to Philly and speak on behalf of A-Step, and there's a stipended position. But if it comes after a certain date where we can't easily Like, if we've already replaced them, yeah, then it's on the contract. It says, like, it's on you to either get yourself replaced or to reimburse us the money that we spent, you know? Right. I think that's the employer's responsibility to get themselves covered, because I think anybody in the city who engages freelancers for work should have a set of flexibilities and,
right,
like, you should just,
if they get something else that pays more, or if they could just get something else that's better for them, yeah,
totally, and that is more, what is it, remunerative,
right,
you know, that they could get just some more flow, like. And I always get a little bit I get a little frustrated or disappointed in the producers or the admin who give, like, actors or freelancers a hard time when they have to make that call and say, mm-hmm, hey, I can't do this anymore. And it's happened to me. I've been on that end. I've also been on the end of the person being like, oh, fuck, you have to, you're telling me that? So I get it. But I think it happened to me a couple of times, and now I'm gaining the insight of, like, this is the culture that I'm a part of. The culture I'm part of is giggers, of they're movers, they're shakers. They take one thing, they love on that thing, and then they realize, oh, there's another path here. I've got to, you know.
Right.
It's that Wendell Berry poem that I quote a lot of, be like the fox, make more tracks than are necessary, some in the wrong direction.
I love Wendell Berry.
Yeah, go all over the place. And if I'm hiring you, I'm going to know that's your lifestyle, and I'm going to put whatever tent poles I need to in our contract, in our little letter of agreement, to make sure that I don't get...
Which is amazing. I wish there were more people like you.
I think increasingly there will be. Because increasingly I'm watching online, like, blog posts by directors, by admin, who are either coming through having freelanced as performers for a while themselves, and so they're bringing a little bit more insight, or just reared in the our generation's truth, which is that we are having to, like, be like Swiss Army knives, all of us,
mm-hmm,
to, especially if we want to live
That's
in this
city. That's a great way to put it.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
The hyphen generation.
Can I ask how your family perceives your career, or how you describe it to them, to try to make them understand the craziness that we're living?
You are really good at asking questions. Is it because you know all the soft spots
I know your secrets, but also just in general, I want the listeners to know the answer to this question.
Oh, no, Jesus, I wish I knew the answer to this question.
Because it's a problem for me, so I want to know what you would say. Because it's an odd lifestyle, and it's a hard thing to explain to people who have never dealt with an artist.
Yeah. And it's funny, because there's some of, I can only speak for my families, but I think it's true for others, where they had to sort of be wrestled from what they maybe thought their son or daughter was going to do to acting. And then they finally get around to sort of understanding and being supportive of what they understand the acting career is. So then they come into a mode of, like, telling their friends about, you know, the school you went to, or the auditions you've gotten on, or, like, some random person that you, like, ended up in a photo with. Like, oh, did you know that,
right,
you know? And so they do their best at supporting you via, like, standing in a way, stepping into, like, the world that they think you're aspiring to, right? Which is mostly movies and television, because that's how most people understand the life of an actor.
My dad believes I am going to be Nicole Kidman.
That's... that's exactly
it's not true, but that's what he understands.
And mine, Andy
to be
Garcia.
My future.
And mine, Andy Garcia. I hope there's an alternative universe where my Andy Garcia is acting in films with your Nicole Kidman.
Our parents would be so happy.
They would be so happy. In that universe, they're happy. I think that it's the problem is one of translation. You use that word, and I think it's right on. It's like, there are people in this community and in this culture who seem to get it sometime. Like you, like we're having this conversation, we're using shorthand. You're asking questions that immediately plunge me into, because there's we're fluent in a sort of language. There's a literacy to what it is to be an artist, to use your words. That fluency does not exist outside of this zip code, these zip codes. It certainly doesn't exist in little, like, West Miami, where I grew up, where Frankie and I grew up. So it's a process of trying to translate from one vernacular to a totally different one. And it is nonstop. It is never, like, I've had... I've had small victories by, you know, doing things like telling my dad that there's no use in him following up, you know, days afterwards with an audition that I've told him about, because I'm trying to put it aside. And
right, and you would tell him if something happened. And I would
would tell him. and so they maybe do that. They do that less. So that was something they were able to understand. You know,
okay.
I have not yet gotten my dad to, like, when I go back home, and we're in the backyard and catch a moment together, to stop, like, asking me questions about Law and Order, or like the television shows that he's been, the procedurals that he watches, and how, why can't my damn agents get me in on those shows? I should be on those shows, you know? And because to get him to gain the right amount of context to realize why that's, like, one, sort of a silly question, and two, like, can somehow inadvertently deflate me a little bit, like, because obviously I'd want to be on those shows. So
right, if you had the chance.
If I had the chance, it's not easy. It takes time. It takes open-mindedness on their part that I think you know, they're older. They think they know it based on the knowledge that they have of it. So I, like I said, my victories have been small. The biggest release that I can say I've gained on the whole issue is I have come in over the last few years, and in particular through conversations with my mom, where I've shared, like, the fact that I think I'm pretty deliberately now articulating a path that is not, like, aimed at the bullseye of being a film star, you know?
Right.
And so the more I grab hold of that, and I turn to my mom and I say, like, hey, this is the new Alejandro. This is, like, what I am looking at now as in my life. And I've gotten from her a sense of, like, oh, okay, good. I'm so glad to know. Go, you know, like, I realized
really positive and supportive.
Positive. And I think it's because all of these misunderstandings and miscommunications are just, like, writhing and flailing in attempts to, like, love each other. And that the person that they actually support is the one who they remember, like, what our teeth looked like when they were falling out, and what our crazy idiosyncratic impulses were when we were 4 and 5. Like, I think they love something that is less easily codified as, like, someone who is an actor or who is a professional. This, like. And
they love our souls,
our spirits.
Your mom loves you as
exactly. And then what happens?
Little baby.
As a little baby, they try to chase our different, like, manifestations of our career, because we share that. We're like, hey, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna go to Juilliard, and we change our minds. And I feel like the comedy of it is that they're, like, running behind us, trying to gain enough understanding to, like, be able to support us, and when they finally catch up, we've moved to another place. Right. So they're talking about Nicole Kidman, and it's like, you know, mom, that's no longer what I'm looking at, or if it ever
or
was.
Or that's something. Not the reality that I'm faced with.
That's not the reality that I'm faced with. And I can try, and I think it's worth trying. I can try to, like, download as much of that through our conversations, through our awkward, like, exchanges as possible. But there's a point in which, we're going to get lost in translation. And I think as long as we can fall back to, like, Okay, we don't understand that about each other yet. But
the fact that she's aware of the difference and she's listening, like the
huge.
The fact that she's aware of the fact that you're in this other environment and you're trying to share it with her is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she's sensitive to how much like distress that this question that you asked has caused me.
Yeah.
Because don't get emotional. I don't count wins that don't go through, that aren't wins for my family. Like, that's the way, one of the ways that I get joy.
You want to share it with your family.
And it doesn't count much if it only happens in New York and the only people who understand why it's a good thing are like my pals here. It matters a lot that they understand why it's a great thing. And it feels great to come back to New York because the people who are in my circle look at me with, I don't know, like I wanted to say respect. If not respect, then understanding. That makes me feel like I'm in my skin and I'm Alejandro in like a full way. Because I'm in New York and people know these things. And I think my mom has been sensitive to the fact that I will turn and toss my whole life away to try to get that understanding and respect in their eyes, when, because I've done some things that I'm incredibly proud of that I can still say, home has only processed about 50% of why that's meaningful. Like I'll do something that took a year and every ounce of my body, and I'll go home and my dad will be like, did that leadership conference happen? Oh, good. I'm glad it went okay. And he'll ask, it went okay. Good. I'm glad. So have you heard about the Florida Marlins?
Oh, that thing I put my entire heart and soul into
everything. Yeah.
That changed 30 people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are little blows. Those are little blows because it matters so much to me. But my mom, just to call her out because you did, I think watched me in that place of like dissonance and so sort of redoubled her efforts to be like, no, you're changing. I'm going to keep my eye on it. Keep talking to me. I'll get there with you, you know, whatever you want to call yourself. Cause it's a process of finding the words, just like that first line of the bio is like, What is it? Theater art. I've recently started using theater art.
I'm so glad
artist.
She's there with you, though. That's an amazing thing for her even to be open to trying to understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's great.
Those are lifesavers, those people. I mean, literally, like, in the C sort of literal version of, like, because I think we want to be seen.
Yeah.
And by, I mean, like, with a capital S, like, seen, seen for what we are. And it just feels good to be in the presence of someone who's seeing you. And I think that's one of the reasons why people stay, despite it being hard to stick around in the city. Like the idea of going to communities far from here where we might be totally invisible in that way.
Right.
There are people here who see, you know, what's
happening.
Can you
talk a little bit about, just because I know you've worked recently as an actor professionally and been paid for it, and as you should be, and you've also made your own work with friends and collaborators, which was beautiful but didn't necessarily pay you for it.
No.
Can you talk a little bit about that difference, about how you feel about being compensated as an artist versus making things that are not being compensated by whatever it is that compensates us as the hierarchy of commerce.
Of value, yeah.
Which we put ourselves into by trying to make money off our art, but there's a, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, and I don't know if this is, I get in debates about this with Ismenia, my girlfriend, a lot. Mm-hmm. So I've come to think of it as maybe a little controversial. Though I know I'm not alone.
No, it is.
Read it people. Is. But I think of the work that I get hired to do as an interpretive artist, like a script that exists, a production that's been budgeted and produced, if you will, and I'm just being hired to show up at a place and do the performance.
Which is satisfying, I'm sure, in a way.
Oh, my God.
Get a paycheck.
But that has increasingly felt like a vacation. Like, oh, my God, you're telling me I can just act?
Right.
I could go to Baltimore and act in a play? What? Yes! You know?
Yeah.
But because of that, it's also the thing that clearly I would do if I could, and the projects were right, I would do a lot more of it, because it's the funnest thing that I do all year is act in plays. Like, and I mean that specifically plays, because the times I've been on set, it's been like stressful and hard work for me. But and I know that there are people who get really accustomed to it and fly. But being in like a rehearsal room and the fluorescent lights and hardwood floors, that's the shit. I know you
and
know.
And that's all you have to worry about. That's you don't have to go home and worry about other things.
And still you that's will it. Worry about it. You will go on the train and you'll be thinking about, you'll go through like... it's just divine. I know I'm talking to somebody who feels the same way.
Totally.
But it's also because I'm like, I try to be really hard-nosed about my assessment. It's also something that I don't think I should assume people are always going to be willing to pay me for. I know enough about the way that markets function and the way that theater is... like underpinned economically, you know, and in terms of subscribers versus grants versus, you know, not-for-profit versus commercial for-profit theaters, the few of them that exist. The fact of the matter is, I wish that there were more of an appetite in this country to pay for theater so that more of my talented theater artist friends could make a living doing it. But because I feel so lucky to be asked to do it for money, I don't go so far as to say like the problem with the theater is that they're not paying us actors enough, or there's not enough jobs for actors. I think there are exactly the amount of jobs as people are as like the audiences are going to see, you know? And so that's where I get led back to education, because I think, well, we need more people who want to see plays and who value it enough to pay ticket prices so that we can get insurance and we can have families. Because the theater is a rare, it's like a an acquired, what it's...
That's a great way to think of it, though, is like developing an audience rather than developing a talent pool.
A talent, oh my goodness. Well, because the economic system is lopsided.
But it's people who want to see theater as opposed to people who want to make theater.
That's it. And that's why work with youth is so getting, like when I take that LaGuardia class to see off-Broadway plays and I see literally, I see one or two kids per play sort of switch over to be like, oh shit, this exists.
Yeah,
like,
this is amazing.
I'm going to go on dates. I'm going to take my, my girl to like see some dope New York theater. Like, I think I just did a better thing taking these kids to Rattlestick than I have done in doing like a 5-month run of a play. Sometimes I feel that way. And I know that performing in good plays, it's like, you know, what is that Keats? I think it's Keats. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. A good play is a joy forever. It resonates into eternity. I'm not downplaying like the work I've done as a performer, but man, in terms of just the, like writing the economics of it all, I feel like creating young people, especially young people of color, like turning them into theater enthusiasts is going to get my friends jobs somewhere down the line.
That's so interesting, yeah. Because I guess I would fear, like as a struggling artist now, I would fear educating people to be future professionals just because it's fucking hard.
Totally. And that's what's funny is that I'm reticent to encourage and educate people towards wanting this to be a profession.
Yeah, because it's hard.
It's totally hard. And whenever I'm in Johannesburg, whenever I'm working with A-Step, whenever we're talking about teaching the arts to young people, I'm the one who's like wants to parse out the clearest that we are giving them art as a lifeline, as a practice,
which
as a meditation.
Also understand and value.
Right.
Yeah.
And that the question about, and I'm pretty clear as far as like where I've come to, as far as them, somebody in our camps or our programs wanting to be a professional musician or be a professional dancer after taking an A-step class or actually taking an Alejandro like theater class, I'm of the belief that if they decide that they can't shake it and they want to monetize it, they will approach me and they will ask me questions about what is it like getting into the profession. At that point, I will deal on a case-by-case basis and be as transparent as possible about this is what it meant for me. Here are some other people who are more like you that you can go talk to about what it meant for them. But to the – and the reason why I make it clear that I wait for them to come up is that I wouldn't impose – the lifestyle of somebody who monetizes their art form on anybody. Why would I want that for young people? If they can't shake it, then they'll come to me after class and be like, yo, Ale, that poetry stuff is amazing. I think I want to be a published poet. Then I can be like, all right, well, let me point you in some directions so people can help you. But let that come from your own dreaming and nightmares and not from me being like, being an actor. I think it's...
No, but it's so important that that's not the ultimate goal. Like, you're getting skills from that for your daily life, for your future. That it's not necessarily being a professional at it, but it's going to enhance your life to learn these creative skills.
Hugely. It might just save... It might be the only hope we have, like, for saving, turning the tides. We're talking about collaborating with people. We're talking about communicating with people. We're talking about... giving feedback
from most of our society nowadays.
It's the biggest thing, and its reach is much broader than arts and classrooms and arts with young people, much broader than the specific demographic that goes to like see plays in theaters. You know, you're getting an opportunity to intersect with people in spaces that won't ever cross that threshold, you know.
Can I ask you, as a writer, is there a special place in New York that you like to go to write? Is there a secret haven you have?
I'm still searching for havens in New York. This year has been a big like quest for them.
Because we've been here for 10 years now.
I know, but I haven't been really identifying as a writer or like actually looking at that lifestyle for the last 8 years. It's only been like a 2-year thing where I'm like, oh, where are my writers? Where are my like havens? Where are my nooks?
Yeah, but what's that like place that makes you feel at peace?
Riverside Park, because we went to school so nearby, and I remember like lots of late night convos with Gabriel Ebert by the rocks or by the benches there. Yeah. And I go still there. Like I find the water wherever possible because the water makes you think deep things. Weirdly enough, when I was writing Sorry, which is the piece you were making reference to, because it was an urban play and I wanted it to sound, or my hope was that it would sound like a city, you know, and not like Emerson or Thoreau or whatever, like, even though that's, I naturally want to go into those places of like nature and serenity. I knew that Sorry had a narrator who like spoke like he was on a train, you know, and libraries. Like New York has this constellation of public libraries, all of which are really different from one another.
I love the public libraries.
Totally. And many of them are play like host to the characters of the characters.
Yes,
like,
people who need somewhere to go.
Totally.
To just kill time.
To kill time, to get some AC. So it was tough because sometimes I'd go on like flurries in the library and other times I wouldn't write anything because I'd just be people watching. I'd be like, yeah, I was going to say something, but who is that dude over there? Yeah.
Okay.
Unlike anyone else, Parks, Tryon, and the Central version. And I think the thing about New York that fits well with my writing as I've understood it right now is like the desire to shake off something I was doing with a walk, like taking a stroll, and to come back to another chapter or to another sort of task. New York is perfect for it because you can just be like, I'm gonna go,
because you feel like you're accomplishing something, like you're doing something.
Oh yeah,
walking,
changing locations. You just sort of like, it's like taking your brain out to pee in the fields. And showers. I learned that Steve Jobs used to take like 4 or 5 showers throughout the day.
I did not know we had this in common.
You take showers
too? Yes.
It's like my one eco.
In the summer, I take at least 2 showers a day.
Yay!
It's my happy place.
For me, it's like a book, turning a page. It's like, I was doing that thing, now I'm not. Yes. Because I'm clean.
Exactly. So what are, when you feel yourself going to the dark side, mm-hmm. what are... something that you turn to, some book, some piece of music, okay,
some more specific, yeah.
Some piece of art that you feel is like an action you can take.
Yeah. I will do a couple of things. Like, I will go to listen to... I think of it as serene music or tranquil music so that you can go into where my brain is right now. The playlist on Spotify is called Pluck the Light Fantastic. And it's because it sounds like that. It's a lot of Iron and Wine.
Okay.
Pigpen Theater Company, which I was listening to the new album as I was coming over here. It has a lot of air in it. It has a lot of like, sentiment, you know, things that just are comfy for me, mm-hmm. and slow my heart rate down. And I'll go to the sun, wherever that may be, or the water, if, like I said, and I'll sometimes like go and I try to find like some really deep or profound piece of like poetry or book, but most often anything that I can get hooked into that I can carry with me in my back pocket. Like, the book definitely has to be paperback so it can go into like a coat. And I'm shameless about continuing to cycle until the book has actually like sunk its teeth into me. So what I'll do in those moments of like, wow, I'll think to myself, what am I reading right now? And 9 times out of 10, I'll realize that there's nothing that I'm carrying around with me that has grabbed me. And it has allowed me to like be in an ether, like a vacuum for a moment, as opposed to have like a world to zoom out.
A book that's drawing you in.
Yeah. And that's, I'm in dialogue with, it's outside of the, because it really is just about having gotten imprisoned for a while in a specific paradigm, a specific set of circumstances. All I can think about is how few auditions I'm going on, or all I can think about is how this other actor is getting this opportunity that I know I could have killed, mm-hmm. if I would have gotten an audition. And so what you're really looking for is something that either allow you to leap over that fence onto another like house for a while,
yeah.
or break that fence down so the world obviously appears huge and diverse again. And I usually find that when I can't get out of that little monastery I've created, that cloister, it's because, oh, I'm not carrying a book around me right now. There's no album that I'm like, you know, meditating on. So then I'll go in search of it and throw a book aside until like I find myself caught.
Something that's really like taking you in.
Taking me in. And for me, you know, it's odd, I think, because we read a lot of plays. It's usually nonfiction for me. I'm trying to get my fiction game, and short stories have helped because short stories are well sized for like subway trips, coffee stops and stuff. And you know, I fell hard for George Saunders' stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm really trying to work on my novel game and trying to get some good recommendations for novels. Do you have any? Have you read any good novels recently?
I just read a book. Because I had been missing that. Because I grew up reading voraciously, and I miss it when I'm not doing it. I just read a book called My Brilliant Friend. So I don't know. I don't want to say you wouldn't like it, because it's about women. I want to think that you would like it.
Sure.
It's about women. It's about like 2 female best friends growing up in Naples in like the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. It's really like mafia driven community.
Whoa.
From the time when they're like 10 or 11 to the time they're maybe 18. It was excellent. Yeah.
Do you remember the writer?
I don't. I'll let you know.
My Brilliant
I'll look
Friend.
It up. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was just saying that I'm trying to expand it.
But I need a new one now, too, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I one of the books that I recently tried to crack and put it aside because it wasn't synchronized, like it wasn't in the moment that I was in. But I do think it's so beautiful, and I wonder if you've heard of it or has ever caught your interest. It's called The God of Small Things.
Yes, I've read that book.
By Arundhati Roy.
Yes, I've read it.
There's a wedding, and she and her sister's coming back. They had been separated, but so far it's just matte, like so lush with description, especially about like the tiny intimate, like the vapor rising off of the fruit, and you know, just all these really small details. And so I think I got to come back to it, but because nonfiction for me is it ends up being like an easier place to go and.
I just read a book. Yeah. It was all about the people who work in the White House, like the staff.
Yeah.
Like the butlers and the cooks and the... what is it called? I just finished it, and it was not necessarily like the best written thing I've ever read, but just fascinating because these people work there through multiple administrations and... Yeah. I think it's just called The Residence.
And was it written by somebody who had worked in the staff? Like what
perspective? No, but this journalist who had interviewed all these people. Oh, yeah, gotcha. It's called The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House. Kate Anderson Brower, I believe. Huh. Tiny print.
Yeah, that's the sort of stuff
that sounds... Yeah, it was fascinating. Because they're like have these relationships with presidents and things that have nothing to do with politics necessarily, but like these very, very personal... relationships that I loved.
Wow. Did you ever see the play about the queen that was here on Broadway recently
called
The
Visit? I didn't. No.
Nor I, but it had the premise of like watching this one, you know, the queen meet all of these prime ministers and the cycling through of like these huge personalities. I think about that and like the person who gets that fixed viewpoint of like change, watching change pass through.
Yeah.
I just, on Sunday, saw the new Annie Baker play called John.
Which I'm hopefully going to see this Friday. Oh. I have standby tickets.
Yes. Cool.
This is great. The next question was, what have you seen in the last month that you want to recommend?
Oh, lucky
so
me.
So tell me about John. Because
I was going to go off on a tangent.
John. No, this is not a tangent. This is what I wanted.
It was, you know, I don't know who's where this is going, but I'm going to be totally honest with you. Mm-hmm. It was magical. And suspenseful, terrifying, and didn't accumulate for me in the very end. Anyway, this is actually a very weird recommendation for it, because I know that I started by saying like, oh, this last act fell off. But what I mean is that I hadn't seen anything like it until that point. And in particular, it's about presences, like extra corporeal, like non-present presences. So the character of John is the name of two people who you never meet but who loom over the play in a big way. There's also a husband of the woman who runs the bed and breakfast, who lives at the bed and breakfast but never shows his face. And multiple things like that, individuals as well as events, like the Civil War, for example, is there are tours and around the whole bed and breakfast. And so you watch like what you get to sort of experience what like haunting feels like. Haunting both in a positive way, like good things lingering, as well as like bad things lingering. And it ends up being quite creepy. So that is a recommendation.
I know you've been out of town. Do you have another one?
Yeah, Preludes, which is closing tomorrow.
Oh, I didn't see it, sadly.
Which is like super epic and emotional, and we get to see our boy Gabe like strut around. Aww. And sing songs. It was good to hear him sing again, but that's closing, and I'm looking forward to seeing in a week Jesse J. Perez in Informed Consent.
Okay. I have to see that too.
Yeah, I think that's a play. I read it and I went out for it. I think you would love that. It's about a woman who's a scientist and her like being torn between her sort of ambition and her drive for her career, as well as some like family and moral concerns and sort of, and the cast is like perfectly diverse. Like the stage directions before the play are like, you know, one of every color. Some, I don't know what it says, but it's basically like,
and it's Liesl Tommy, right?
And who's directing? Who's
the best?
Who's the best? So we'll see that.
Well, I want to wrap this up just because I know you have to be somewhere, so I don't want to hold you too long. But
oh, it's fine.
Thank you so much for talking with me and going on this adventure with me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.